And welcome back to Coast, where the next 3 hours, our special reporter, investigator Linda Moulton Howe joins us with some incredible stories of high strangeness. Plus, the last hour, we always reserve it, and it's called Conversations with Linda, giving you an opportunity to talk with her, questions, or even some tips for upcoming stories. We'll be back with Linda in a moment. Get right into this on Coast to Coast AM. Well, the major holidays have come and gone, and that means Linda is back on her regular last Thursday schedule. And Linda, looking forward to your reports tonight.
Well, thank you, and Happy New Year, and Happy New Year to all of our Coast listeners. It has been an exciting beginning to this year. On Saturday morning, January 13th at 8:07 a.m. in Hawaii, cell phones blared a terrifying alert. Oh,
scared everybody out there.
Yeah, and they said, ballistic missile threat inbound to Hawaii. Seek immediate shelter. This is not a drill. And then across TV and radio networks came another emergency alert. If you are outdoors, seek immediate shelter in a building. Remain indoors, well away from windows. If you are driving, pull safely to the side of the road and seek shelter. And during the next 38 minutes, parents even tried to put young children down storm drains into sewers in the street.
Jeez.
USPGA Tour golf pro John Peterson tweeted, I'm under mattresses in the bathtub with my wife, baby, and in-laws. Please, Lord, let this bomb threat not be real. And TV news began to run interviews with lots of Hawaiian residents, most saying the same thing over and over. I didn't know what I was supposed to do or where to go. Americans are clearly not prepared for nuclear attacks. After 38 minutes, the missile warning was canceled as human computer error. But Hawaii's governor, David Ige, after a brief tweet, did not go on TV to talk to his state's panicked citizens for at least 5 more hours. And that's when he apologized for the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency's human mistake, described, quote, as a veteran agency employee picking the wrong option on his computer for a routine drill and then confirming his wrong choice. And today, the New York Times reported that that person is not cooperating with the Federal Communications Commission investigation. So far, no explanation has been given for the lack of cooperation.
And they kept him. They moved him to a different department, but he's still employed.
That's right. It's very bizarre. We probably haven't heard the end of that story. Well, then, 3 days later on Tuesday, January 16th, another false missile alarm was set off, this time in Japan. It happened when mainstream media broadcaster NHK sent out a news alert that North Korea had launched a nuclear missile and that Japanese citizens should take shelter. However, 5 minutes later then, an NHK spokesman apologized, saying that one of their own staff had mistakenly operated the equipment to deliver news alerts over the Internet. Well, the day after the false alarm set off panic in the Hawaiian Islands, on January 14th, the New York Times headlined, What Nuclear Experts Are Afraid Of, quote, Hawaii false alarm hints at thin line between mishap and nuclear war. And the question is it really possible in this near middle of the 21st century to kick off a deadly nuclear war by accident? And adding fuel to the real nuclear missile threat question are U.S. President Donald Trump, who has tweeted insults to North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un, who has tweeted back insults to Trump, calling him the bark of a rabid dog and a spasm of a lunatic. And one man who was 20 years old at the time of Three Mile Island, when the nuclear power plant there suffered a partial meltdown on March 28, 1979. Scott Portsline, 20 years old, was living there and having to deal with something that none of us would want to ever deal with, and that is nuclear radiation around where you live. Since then, Scott Portsline has devoted his life to monitoring safety and security at nuclear power plants and trying to help people understand how dangerous nuclear weapons are. He is a member of the Three Mile Island Alert and the Security Committee Chairman in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He also investigates lost and stolen materials of nuclear nature in the United States. And after I heard so many Hawaiians on TV news saying, I don't know what to do or where to go, I called Scott Portzline for answers. And here now, from Harrisburg, PA, is Scott Portzline.
If you're outside, you could easily be doomed. A person wants to go as far below ground as possible because of the shielding that's created by the ground. What you're protecting yourself against is the heat and the fire and the initial radiation. You're also protecting yourself against the blast pressure, the huge shockwave that can knock down buildings. You don't want to have your eyes open looking out the windows, because if you see that blinding light, it might render you blind for the rest of your life. So you don't want to do that. Another thing you don't want to do is shelter in a sewer. I feel so sad that I saw a video of people showing how they had put their children down manholes to protect them by putting them underground. But that, of course, is what the government said to do. It's on their webpage.
And you're talking, Scott, about what we saw on television on Saturday, January 13th, in that 38-minute period in Hawaii,
yes,
that there were parents trying to put their young children down manhole covers.
Yeah, and that could have killed them over a false alarm because of the gases. There's very dangerous and toxic gases that can build up in a sewer line. Hydrogen sulfide, ammonia, methane, carbon monoxide, and sulfur dioxide, to name a few. So don't do that. And the government needs to put things like that on their website.
You mean they need to say caution on their federal websites? Do not put children and animals down manhole covers underground because of poisonous, toxic fumes.
Exactly. Yes, that has to be there. If you're going to tell people to go as far below ground as possible or shelter underground, then you need to specify any dangers associated with that, because we're giving people options here. Not all options are going to work out, and some of the options come with a high price. I don't want to put my child in a sewer and have a chance of killing him, especially if it's a false alarm. And if you were to be outside and have fallout particles come down on you, you're going to need to take off all your clothes and shower and bathe and bury your clothes if you have time or ability to do that, to get away from the radiation that the clothes would be contaminated with.
Scott, I have heard a recommendation that if you were outside or near a window or a deck when there was an atomic blast and you survived and that you had access to running water, that you should shower for at least 20 minutes.
Oh, yeah, I would take several showers, actually. But here again, you're torn between, you have to pick your options. Just because you survive one blast doesn't mean there's not another blast coming. It depends on who's behind this and what type of war we're having.
Mm.
So you may survive one blast, but maybe not a second. Now, that's getting to the extreme, but that is part of our reality, unfortunately. What we're dealing with now is the scenario that happened in Hawaii and what people should do. They should definitely take shelter immediately. Now, if they had a plan, they would have what's called a Faraday bag or a Faraday cage to protect their communication devices, like a radio and their cell phone.
Can you explain for the average person what a Faraday cage is, where they can get them, and how fast they would have to put their communication devices in it?
Yes. A Faraday cage is a metal container to block out the electromagnetic pulse that's generated in 1/1,000,000th of a second during a nuclear blast, far faster than any surge protection devices that we have can protect your device. You know, it's a switch that basically opens up when it gets a high voltage. Well, these EMPs that result from the nuclear blast will wipe out your cell phone, your radio. So now, if you're in a shelter but didn't protect those devices, now you're very tempted to come back out too soon. And you're going to be frantic trying to find out where your loved ones are and what's happened to them. That's why it's very, very important to have a Faraday cage or bag of some sort. And here's how you do that. You can go online and buy a simple Faraday bag for less than $10. I prefer, if you're doing your planning, and you should, go get a small metallic outdoor-type trash can that's maybe 2 feet high. You don't want something enormous. And it has a metal lid. And so after you've made your phone call to a couple of loved ones saying, here's where I'm going, you know, I'm following my plan for when I'm at work, and I'm going to be in this shelter. In the meantime, I'm turning off my cell phone, and hopefully the radio will still work when we pull it out of our Faraday cage after we decide it's time to try to establish contact again. The range of an EMP bomb depends on the yield of the bomb and the altitude. Some people think the EMP threat is overstated, but definitely on a local level where we're dealing with miles, I don't think it is overstated at all.
The EMP is being talked about in many circles as perhaps being more damaging of a large infrastructure, bringing down all electricity, and that would, in the long run, be worse to the large population of the United States than even the takeout of a city like San Francisco.
Oh, yeah, that's true. In some cases, it may take 2 days until you can come out. Radiation actually disintegrates, or decays, I should say, rather rapidly. Let me give you some numbers here. Mm-hmm. So what is fallout? It's the radioactive particles that rain down from the sky as they become heavy enough to fall down, or sometimes literally in rain that can be triggered after a nuclear blast. And when a nuclear device, a nuclear bomb goes off, it creates hundreds of different radionuclides. Most of these decay to stable elements within a few seconds to minutes, but about 160 will be radioactive after 1 hour. Then after a few hours, there will be about 80 different nucleides having a range of less than 1 second to 30 years of lifetime. So radionuclides with less than a 7-day half-life virtually disappear within 8 to 10 weeks by becoming stable. Actually, most of the fallout decays rather rapidly compared to the first 12 to 24 hours. But there's about 20 radionuclides in fallout that have a half-life of more than 7 days, and that constitutes the long-term radioactive contamination that we worry about, things like strontium, thorium, and, of course, uranium and plutonium. After about a year, very little radioactive remains in the fallout residue, near background level, but just a little bit higher than it ought to be. Now, after the blast occurs, wait a little while and try to turn on your radio to hear if there's any communications giving you directions or updating you on what's going on. That's going to be natural, too. Try to use your cell phone. Good luck with that, because the EMP might have taken out everything. And really, the same with the radio transmissions. Because of the lingering radioactivity, you may have very poor communications or very scratchy signals from a radio station, but over some time, you'll get that back. The panic that people have to fight will be tremendous, the psychological worries, and you can't feel doomed. You have to concentrate on focusing on living, and you may have to go a day without food and water if you hadn't prepared, but most people can do that. Then, after the first day or two, you'll start to get a sense of what the government's telling you on where the radiation is being measured and where it may be safe or not. The government may have recommendations to evacuate a certain area to another specific area, and maybe the government will even be able to provide transportation with them. You're going to be checking yourself for the symptoms of radiation. So with a medium dose of radiation, you're going to have nausea and vomiting first within 2 hours or even 1 hour. If it's severe amount of radiation, that'll happen within 10 minutes. And if that's happening, you're probably going to die. Diarrhea is the next thing that you'll notice, and that happens within 8 hours on a higher dose within 1 hour. And you'll have a headache within the first day. I think everybody's going to have a tension headache anyhow. So you'll have a fever. Your body's going to have to cope with all these cells that are dead, including in your blood and in your bone marrow. And you'll have a fever as the body's trying to get rid of these unwanted bacteria that will start to grow also. That will be within 3 hours, even 1 hour. You'll suffer from dizziness and disorientation within a week if you're getting very sick.
And Scott, what you mean is that if you're close enough or the blast is intense enough that the radiation is going to kill the bacteria in your own body, and that's going to cause illness inside of the person still alive.
Well, that's a good point, because it's actually twofold. As you have cells that are dead within you, their foreign bodies in your immune system will surround them with pus and try to get rid of them, and you may develop a fever. If you've ever had a bad infection in a limb, sometimes you'll notice that that limb is actually warmer than the rest of the body. But you're right. The good bacteria also gets killed, and your colon and stomach lining won't be able to digest your food. So what happens within a week, you'll have bloody vomit and stools, and the infections will be occurring, and your wounds won't be healing, and you'll have low blood pressure. So these are all the symptoms of radiation illness, and if the government's prepared, they'll be able to measure the radioactive dose that you may have received.
Wow, what a story.
You know, it is so serious and so sobering, but this is exactly the kind of information that we all need to be educated about. It doesn't do any good to have everything always sugar-coated or not stated, or information like they had at one of the websites about putting kids down a sewer because it would be underground when you could end up hurting kids. And I'm hoping that this report tonight can be followed by a lot of people doing more research, because this is important that we all be educated. And even the governor of Hawaii, David Ige, when he did his State of the State address about a week ago, he admitted, he said that he confessed that the reason that it took him 5 hours to go on to, I guess it was tweeting, and then he did a television, was, here's a quote, "I have to confess, I don't know my Twitter account logons and the passwords." And so
he's got a staff that probably doesn't.
Well, you would think, but that's what he said was the reason that it took him so long, which is another part of being prepared in an emergency. And I have been studying something that I had never really read in depth before. It is called An Introduction to Nuclear Electromagnetic Pulse by Jerry Emanuelson. He's an electrical engineer, and he put this together because of the same feeling that people talk about EMP blasts. And I may have to finish on the other side of the next half hour, but I just want to say that he quotes, "Although nuclear EMP was known since the very first days of nuclear weapons," that's going back to the mid-1940s, "the magnitude of the effects of high-altitude nuclear EMP were not known until a 1962 test of a thermonuclear weapon in space called the Starfish Prime test."
How could that take so long, Linda? We're going to come back and talk more on Coast to Coast AM with Linda Moulton Howe. And we are back with investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Linda, and 3 days later after the Hawaiian disaster, there was another one in Japan.
That's right. And that's a part of what I talked about in the first half hour, and picking up where I left off about the whole issue of electromagnetic pulse. We hear people kick that around, and there is, in my Earth Files news tonight, I have two parts. Could nuclear war start by accident? And the fact that the Pentagon wants to counter cyber attacks with nuclear arms. And in this, everywhere, written in between the lines, is what about EMPs, electromagnetic pulses, from blowing and blasting a nuclear armament up in the air? Well, In part one, I would urge you and everyone to go to Earth Files and open up Could Nuclear War Start by Accident and scroll down to one of the eeriest photographs I have ever seen. It is color. It is the midnight sky after the Starfish Prime nuclear EMP test of 1962. They didn't know what was going to happen, and they were only using a 1.44 megaton thermonuclear warhead. And they detonated it at an altitude of 250 miles at about 900 miles from Honolulu, Hawaii. And yet, when you look at this photo that happened just soon to midnight, and you realize that the way it was described about what happened, that this test knocked out some of the electrical and electronic components in Hawaii, 897 miles away, and that this eerie test made no sound, and yet it was set off this huge light bulb in the sky, and everybody was slightly shocked at the power of it. Well, today, we're now moving into part two in this second half hour. Today, we're talking about 150 kilotons in North Korea, that the United States may have 30 megaton bombs, all of these much larger, and that on January 16th, the New York Times reported that, quote, a newly drafted United States Nuclear Posture Review January 2018 sent to President Donald Trump for approval would permit the use of nuclear weapons to respond to a wide range of devastating but non-nuclear attacks on American infrastructure, close quote. And that means cyber attacks that can take down, say, for example, large power grids. And that prior to the Trump administration, DOD would consider nuclear weapons only in extreme circumstances, and now that is being defined as including cyber attacks. And the New York Times headline, Pentagon suggests countering devastating hot cyber attacks with nuclear arms. And the Department of Defense knows that adversaries such as Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran have all done some moderate forms of cyber attacks and hacking, and that Russia has infiltrated some American utility systems with what they call black energy. But none of that to date has caused a major blackout in a large region of the United States, which would certainly happen if there was an EMP. However, the very fact that there are now geopolitical discussions about even wanting to use nuclear arms in retaliation for cyber attacks means the chances increase that it could happen. And here now to continue our discussion is Scott Portzline, Three Mile Island Alert Security Committee Chairman from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania.
Could you now please go into the details of the size of bombs? And you sent me San Francisco and Hawaii. Maybe you could use those and explain what current damage would be.
Okay. The North Korean bombs right now is estimated to be 150 kilotons. That's 10 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb we used against an enemy. That's the same yield as is currently on a U.S. nuclear cruise missile. These are missiles that can be fired from submarines or aircraft, and they are low-flying jet-powered missiles that have programmed into them a flight path at low altitude that follows the terrain. So if one were to hit Honolulu, Hawaii, it would wipe out everything between the airport and Diamond Head. The fireball itself from the blast is half a mile wide. The radiation that is released, like gamma rays and so forth, which is a direct shine onto a person, is 1.25 miles wide. 50% or more of the people will die within several hours to several weeks. So that's actually a smaller bomb, but, you know, you're wiping out a city. And the air blast itself can knock down buildings, and it's going to rupture eardrums and cause many injuries. The air blast itself is 4 2/3 miles wide. The thermal blast will burn people's skin, third-degree burns, 6.5 miles wide. Some of the burns will not cause much pain because it'll destroy the nerves. It'll burn so deeply through the skin that it'll kill the nerves, and so some of those people won't even have much pain from the burns. But it'll be so bad that some of the people will require amputations.
Wow. And I'm looking at the colored nuke maps that you sent. There's a website. Could you give out the URL for these nuke maps?
Yes, it's nuclearsecrecy.com/nukemap. And they're spelling nuke map, N-U-K-E-M-A-P.
I am looking at the map for Hawaii, since this has been the most recent alert on January 13th. If I'm reading this correctly, it is showing that all of downtown Honolulu would be gone.
Yes.
And that they're estimating the fatalities at 142,600.
Yes, those are estimates. And then the injuries, 167,700. These are very good maps because you can enter any city in the world. It's like a Google map. And then you can enter the size of the weapon.
Let's say in terms of miles from San Francisco or Honolulu in these nuke maps, how many miles on average will people be able to survive?
Depends on the yield. But with the North Korean size, 150 kiloton, the ionizing radiation, which is deadly to about 50% of people, is 1.25 miles. But the thermal radiation is 6.5 miles wide. So it's easy to see that there's going to be a lot of people severely injured and possibly dying from just the thermal burns from 6 miles. If you go to the nuke map, you can enter a different yield. So enter 30 megatons. You're going to see something entirely different, and it'll make you sick because you're going to see, in some cases, the thermal range will be 50 miles in diameter.
Okay, let's say there is a blast. You're still there. You're still alive. You had the Faraday cage. You had your electronics in there, but you haven't done anything to the windows. Would you then accomplish anything about helping to keep radiation out after a blast if you then start gaffer taping from the inside of the house?
Yes, because it will be just like the dirty bomb scenarios. What we're trying to do is prevent the ingress of radioactive particles, particulate matter, that would come in. And you want to turn off your circulation fans so you're not drawing it from another room in your house. It's going to be a tough time. I already have my plastic cut to size. I don't even have to fool around when it's time to go to my safe room in my house.
We've been talking about some of the practical aspects of what we're dealing with. If there is a 150 kiloton nuclear attack from North Korea or a 30 megaton attack from some other country, let's go to the January 16th, 2018 New York Times big headline. The Pentagon suggests countering devastating cyber attacks with nuclear arms. And here's the first paragraph, quote, a newly drafted United States nuclear strategy that has been sent to President Trump for approval would permit the use of nuclear weapons to respond to a wide range of devastating but non-nuclear attacks on American infrastructure, including what current and former government officials have described as the most crippling kind of cyber attacks, close quote. Scott, what is your perspective on countering cyber attacks with nuclear attacks?
Well, I actually think it's a necessity, and I'm going to have a lot of people hating me for that thought. But when you consider losing the grid or the damage to a nation that can occur from cyber attacks, it can bring a nation to its knees. So we have to be sure to let other nations know if you do something like this, your nation's not going to exist. And that's that horrible concept of mutually assured destruction. But the truth is, for at least the last 60 years, it's worked. We could see an unprecedented number of false warnings being issued by cyber attacks, and think how upsetting that will be to people. And this is one reason the United States is considering retaliating that type of manipulation with a nuclear attack.
But we're dealing now with taunts and indescribable words going on between the leader of North Korea and the president of the United States. What if it did escalate to the North Korean saying, okay, I'm going to blast Hawaii? Experts believe that he has the capability of at least putting a 150 kiloton on a missile.
Yeah, we're in the awful truth of two neighbors arguing and fighting. So they both dump a foot of gasoline in their yard, and they're saying, I'm going to light this match. And we have two leaders of our nation and North Korea who are also showing off, and they're walking around smoking a cigarette, saying, see, I'm not afraid of you. My cigarette's bigger than yours, and we're going to be all right. Trust me. You'll see. Well, that's where we're at today, and it's madness. So each advance in technology and other nations wanting to advance their technologies brings us closer and closer to this sort of destruction, and it can happen by accident, not just from bravado. I really think that North Korea is going to use a different technique, and that's with a fishing boat or a cargo vessel or a shipment of some sort, and they could bring a dozen nuclear weapons into the United States that go undetected. Let's say 60% of them work, and be detonated across our nation. What do we do then? Who are we going to blame? I mean, this will be the devastation that's possible. North Korea, I think, is doing a lot of posturing for political reasons and economic reasons, but I think the way they fight is going to be unexpected.
So you're suggesting, Scott, that they could use something like a suitcase bomb inside of a fishing trawler or some boat or some kind of vehicle that they got into the United States.
Yes. Photographs of what they claim is their thermonuclear bomb would easily fit in a shipping container.
Do we have any way to monitor, X-ray, or see a suitcase bomb in one of the shipping containers of the hundreds of thousands that are going through the world all the time?
Yeah, we do have a way, but it's the needle in the haystack still. The last numbers that I had, and these are old numbers, was that only about 2% of our containers were being monitored in that manner. You better believe that not everyone's being checked. So let's say that North Korea or another nation tried to introduce something like that into the United States, and half of the containers get caught. Doesn't matter. Those other ones that come through and are successfully detonated will change the world.
Do you feel that in the next decade that what we've been talking about today could actually happen?
Yeah, I also worry about Pakistan and India, who definitely do not trust each other. All of our nations are on this hair trigger alert. North Korea doesn't have that yet. But because of the hair trigger alert, the idea is we need to launch our weapons before they are destroyed by an incoming attack. But the problem is, we almost did start a nuclear strike because of errors with people or computers or radars or satellites. In 1960, NORAD, that's the North American Aerospace Defense Command, in Thule, Greenland, I've been to that Air Force base, and I saw the radar screens there. They used to have four huge football field-sized radar screens looking over the North Pole to detect incoming missiles from the former Soviet Union. It was part of the early warning system, which was a series of radar sites stretching from Greenland across northern Canada and terminating in Alaska. Well, on that particular day, the system was very new. The computer concluded that there was a massive incoming missile strike from the Soviet Union, and computers calculated a confidence level at being 99.9% certain that it was correct. And the radar was echoing off the moon, and the moon had just come up over the horizon. It wasn't missiles. It was the moon.
What a disaster that could have been. Oh, my God.
No, it is amazing when you look back through history and you study some of this and you realize how lucky we have been or something protecting us. I have in front of me testimony before the United States Congress House Armed Services Committee. The date was October 7, 1999. It was a very eminent physicist, Dr. Lowell Wood, and he was talking about that Starfish Prime EMP test that I was referring to before, and that I have this eerie photo at Earth Files. And he was making such an interesting point about how, without knowing what was going to happen, we were doing tests without realizing what the consequences would be. And he said, most fortunately, these EMP tests took place over Johnston Island in the mid-Pacific rather than the Nevada test site, or electromagnetic pulse would still be indelibly imprinted in the minds of the citizens of the Western United States, as well as in the history books, because there was significant damage done to both civilian and military electrical systems throughout the Hawaiian Islands, and they were 800 miles from ground zero. If they had done this EMP test at the Nevada test site, draw a circle 800 miles out, this would have damaged all over the Southwest, all the way to the ocean, and north, south, east, west.
Jeez.
And that, thank heavens, they had been doing these tests out in the Pacific on islands, but nevertheless, we're at another one of those crucial crossroads.
We are. Up next, climate change and what's it doing to some of the species in the sea.